I have a bunch of kids. I know I probably don't look like it, but I do actually. I have four. The oldest is five. So I have a bunch of kids, and it's very loud in my house. So I need a little bit of help to get over distractions. I tend to keep doing things until something really loud happens. So you may have to shout loudly. But it's me. It's not you. Welcome, everyone. I'm glad that you've come here today. My name is Joy Pullman. I live in Fort Wayne. As I mentioned, I have four children. We homeschool them. I'm a homeschool graduate. I also work for the Heartland Institute. That is a Chicago-based free market think tank. And so I, for many years, ran their education division and their education newspaper. So I basically spent my life researching on education. I have a book coming out in a couple of months from Encounter Books about Common Core. So I won a journalism fellowship from the Robert Novak Foundation to report about that right when it was starting to come out, just about the year before people started to notice that it was a thing that was happening in public schools. So as a result of a lot of the research that I did during that time, the reporting, I was one of the first people to be paying attention to it and critically looking at it back when it wasn't really on anyone's radar screen. So as a result of that, I've spent a lot of time looking at the history and structure of U.S. education. So I wanted to open with an illustration that you are probably all pretty familiar with since this is a Christian conference. It's Jesus' parable of the wheat and the tares. You probably all know the story. He tells the story of a man who owned a field, and he had his servants go sow wheat into the field. And at night, an enemy of the master came, and they sowed weed seeds. And then when both of the plants started sprouting up, the man's servants came to him and said, "Look, master, what is happening? You know, we see both wheat and weed seeds growing in your garden." And the master said, "Well, let them grow up together, and when they are both mature, then we'll separate the weeds from the wheat, and we'll throw the weeds into the fire." So the applicability of that today is, as I'm going to be talking about a number of trends that have been happening, the way that American education has been changing from the way that it was in our founders when America was created and was established, to the way that it is today, it's very, very different, and there have been a number of parallel trends that have grown up together, and now they're starting to bear fruit. And so I think of Common Core as not a surprising, it isn't a surprising random development, although it has surprised a lot of people. But it actually is the natural result of having an American education system set up the way that it is. So we're going to talk about a number of the ways that basically two opposite approaches to education philosophy are bearing fruit right now in our education and our family policies that our lawmakers are passing, or in many instances now our lawmakers don't even pass things. They hand things off to the administrative state, and a bunch of unelected bureaucrats are the ones who get to decide what is going to affect your children, your families, and the kind of education that you are allowed to give to your children. So the first, but before I get into some specifics here, I am going to run through a number of kind of interconnected initiatives that are happening right now that you want to be aware of if you want to be an informed person in the education ecosystem. But I want you to be thinking of these major themes first. The first thing that you need to know is that, number one, you cannot hide. As a homeschool graduate, I grew up, you know, around a lot of people who thought that they could keep their kids safe by taking them out of public schools, but they could protect them within homeschooling. That is not possible anymore. And it maybe never was possible. I mean, I don't know. It's kind of hard for me to gauge where an audience is, you know, based on whether you're new to homeschooling, you've been doing it a long time, you're a homeschool graduate like I am, but there have been a lot of discussions recently among more mature homeschoolers, families who have been doing it over several generations now, about how, you know, they thought that they could protect their children, and then, you know, their children, you know, ran away and rebelled against their family and went crazy, and they thought that homeschooling would protect them, and that wasn't the case, right? Because we're all a bunch of sinners, and, you know, it's kind of like Solzhenitsyn says about evil, the dividing line between good and evil runs through every single human heart, right? So if you have sinners in your home, you're going to have evil in your home. Okay, but so that said, so you can't protect your children by homeschooling. You can, however, you know, fulfill your responsibility, your God-given responsibility to your children to give them the best that you are capable of doing, right? Because that is what all of us are trying to do. Fulfill our responsibilities as a mom and dad to give our kids the best that we can do. For some families, that is homeschooling. For some families, that's a number of other options. But the number one thing that I think, you know, big picture thing that I think you need to accept is that you can't hide. And from these, so I'm going to talk about a bunch of these initiatives that are going to influence your family. A lot of people think and hope and wish, and I would prefer this myself, right, that we can just close our doors and do what we want and let everyone else, you know, deal with the mess that is out there. But the people in charge of government policies today are knocking down your door, they're entering your home, and you are not going to be able to protect your families unless you do your civic duty and vote and inform your representatives, you know, that you're not going to stand for people, you know, basically coming into your homes and, you know, transgressing the boundaries you've set up around your family. So the second thing that you need to understand overarchingly is that it's all connected. So if you just... homeschooling is not an isolated, you know, thing that people do. Neither is a public school an isolated thing. All of the policies that a government or, you know, different levels of government have, they interlock, they fit together, they work in conjunction with each other. So let me give an illustration of that, a very simple one. So, for example, if we have, which we do, divorce laws that make it easy for families to break up, you know, basically for any reason you want, you can go ahead and divorce. Well, that's going to lead to, of course, easier divorces, more divorced families, and the social science shows that broken families harm children. They make them more emotionally vulnerable, they make them more likely to act out and so forth. So what happens? Those children go into public schools, and teachers are having to now discipline children and spend much of their time doing basically the parents' job, you know, of handling their children's emotional problems, rather than actually doing the teacher's job, which is conveying knowledge to children. So that's a number, you know, that's one of the reasons that families, you know, are pulling their children out is not just the academics, but it's the social situation in schools, depending on where you live. But the point being that that is not, you know, a divorce law is not a public school policy. It is not a homeschool policy. But because we're people, we're integrated people, we're all one, you know, person. You cannot separate your family policies, your social welfare policies, and so forth from your education policies and et cetera. So the progressive folks on the left side of the political spectrum have understood this for a very long time. But I think people, especially Republican politicians, and I'm an equal opportunity critic of both of our major political parties, so especially Republican politicians have this kind of binary mindset about policies where they don't see that they are interconnected and, you know, a family social policy such as divorce, such as the way that social services manages its caseloads and so forth, those have direct effects on your family, on your ability to have a good education for your kids, to have your children growing up in a safe culture that is supporting, you know, a supportive environment for them, you know, to be happy individuals, to have a good life. Okay, so if you, I assume since you're a homeschooler, you care about education freedom, right? You want to have the right to teach your kids what you think they should be learning, not what some third party thinks they should be learning, because you are the one who looks at your child, who hears your child crying, who knows your child's personality. And so you are the one who knows your child best and is best suited to determining what kind of education will be the best fit for your child. And again, social science, you know, supports that obvious common sense thing. One of the things I always like to say is, you know, social science and common sense, because a lot of times nowadays, what is common sense? You have to prove, you know, you have to prove that, you know, maybe fighting parents is going to make a child sad, right? I don't know why I need to prove that. I need to prove that because, you know, some people have a political reason to want to say the opposite, so you have to support it. Okay, so but if you care about true education freedom, you have to be aware of how people who do not think you have the right to homeschool are constructing a giant government dragnet to curtail that right. We live in a quasi-socialist welfare state. Plain fact, you know, our government spends more money on welfare policies than socialist nations in Europe and the Scandinavian countries. And our country is gradually becoming more European. Gradually, we think we live in a representative government. That's probably what you're teaching your kids in their basic American classes. But the reality is that, and I will give you example, I'll actually give you a quick example of this. In Indiana, we're the first state to have technically repealed Common Core. We still have Common Core tests, we still have Common Core textbooks, we still have Common Core classes being given to children in public schools, in private schools across the state of Indiana. Why is that? Because Governor Pence, he basically said, well, we're scared of losing federal dollars, so we'll let the federal government tell us what kids should have, and they want Common Core, so we're just going to rename Common Core and put it back in place and tell Hoosiers that you don't have it in your schools. That's what he did, and he did that knowingly. Andrea Neal, who is one of the state board members that he appointed to the State Board of Education, he and the independent experts that he had analyze the curriculum documents now governing Indiana schools told him to his face in person, this is what is happening, and he went ahead and he voted for it at the Education Roundtable meeting that our state had a couple of years ago concerning the Common Core question. So all of that. So when you say, you know, you think we have a representative government where, you know, you vote for someone, you tell them this is the policy I want, and there were hundreds of thousands of Hoosiers, you know, stampeding the state capitol for all of those hearings saying this is what we want, and, you know, well, we got precisely the opposite while we have our state leaders telling us we gave you what you want, which at best is willful misrepresentation. So... I told you I was going to be an equal opportunity government critic, and I definitely am. So, but let's go ahead then and talk about, I want to talk about a number of different and interconnected policies at both the state and the federal levels that are kind of constructing this alternate ecosystem, this way of thinking about education that is directly opposed to your ability to homeschool your child, to decide, even if you don't homeschool your child, to decide what school your child will go to, what teachers your child will have, you know, how they will learn, in what manner, in what environment. Because... So I also work for this online publication called The Federalist. We're one of the largest conservative news magazines in the country, in the world. And so I, one of the folks that I live with, she her name is Stella Morabito. She is a writer. She used to work for the federal government as an analyst of Soviet propaganda. So one of her things that she mentions as a student of history, especially communist history, is that a centralized state competes with parents for control over children. So you as a parent of your child are a competitor to a socialist, a collectivist way of arranging society. That is just, if you stand up for parents' rights, you are, by doing so, fighting against a collectivist mentality. Because the folks who think that children belong to all of us, that's a quote from a lady who is a, you know, TV show host for MSNBC, you know, it's all our children. We hear that coming from several Obama administration officials. So basically, your right to choose and decide is directly opposed to a bureaucrat's right to choose and decide. So I'm being very direct here because the times that we live in are such that it's very distressing to someone who pays attention to what is happening. So rather than just sit here and talk about it, let me give you examples. Let me prove that what I'm saying is true with evidence about what's going on in our laws. And most of the time, these aren't laws. These are regulations, right? Because, again, what happens is not exactly what is put into a law, but when it's passed off to a regulatory agency, they effectively make the law because they get to interpret it. Okay, so I'm going to just list a number of things that I'm going to talk about, a number of these different major initiatives that are connected within the education policy ecosystem. I call it an ecosystem to kind of help emphasize in your mind that it's connected, right? These are not isolated, but they work together. They're all part of, you know, thinking of education of children as families in one way, which happens to be opposite to the way that I think about children and families and education. So one, we're going to talk about interconnected government databases. Two, we're going to talk about health and preschool measures, and those are connected, government health programs as well as early child care preschool measures. We're going to talk about curriculum and Common Core. We're going to talk about testing. And then I have kind of a little basket for talking about a number of other policies that also affect your ability to educate your children and make choices about, again, what kind of a community you're going to live in, what kind of rights you have as a family to decide what your family will do, when, and why. So let's talk about this. The first thing that you need to know, which I don't think this is as common knowledge, but since the 1990s, the federal government has given states, every single state except about two, which unfortunately does not include Indiana, a series of grants to create what are called SLDS, Student Longitudinal Data Systems. You can look up Indiana's if you just put in Student Longitudinal Data System, and then you will... I'm trying to think of the other search term that you'll find, but there's a government website that shows every single grant that they have given to all these state agencies, and in the grant it tells you what the money is for. So I've looked up Indiana's among, as well as a number of other states, because I've testified in front of about 14 state legislatures, and every time I go to testify in front of a state legislature, I look up the grant to find out what basically they've promised the federal government they're going to track about children. So Indiana has such a database. It's currently going under the moniker the Indiana Network of Knowledge, Inc. And our Inc. database, I have a link in my notes here to a kind of a big article by the Indy Star about this. It's supposed to follow children from, well, right now, they're just working on following children from school all the way through career. But they also are discussing, I've looked up, you know, the meeting notes where the folks in charge of the task force, don't you love, you know, how bureaucratic that sounds, the task force in charge of, which, you know, none of these people can you elect, right? But you pay their salary, you can elect them, you pay their salary, and it's a very nice salary too, but you can't, you know, elect them or vote them out of office or anything else. But anyway, so that the meeting minutes, our unelected officials are currently talking about connecting this massive database that they're constructing to track every single Indiana child. And they're planning to connect that to health and welfare data starting with child before they're born. This is something that that state databases are doing across the country. The Oregon Commissioner, Associate Commissioner of Education, talked about how education starts prenatally. They want to track mothers before the children are born because, and this is a paraphrase of what he said, it's in a video, you know, if any of you are interested, I'm happy to send it to you, where he talks about, of course, the mother's nutrition is important to how the baby's brain is growing, so we have to track the nutrition that a mother is getting while she's pregnant and connect that nutrition to the child when he gets, and then he gets, which our state is also doing, connecting an individual student identifier to each child, you know, and then, so basically as he moves throughout his life, they're attaching all of these other things that happened to him. Did he attend a preschool program? Which one? Who was his teacher? What were his test scores? So Indiana's Network of Knowledge, Inc., is putting together all of those things with the goal of tracking children and basically doing studies on them. And to be honest, this is basically, the justification for this is economic planning. The goal is to say, you know, we want to be able to say, if a child went to preschool, what are his earnings when he's 40 years old? If a child did not go to preschool, what are his earnings when he's 40 years old? If he or she majored in college, you know, in gender studies versus science, what is their earnings at 40, 50 years old? Which I could already probably tell you because that's already available from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But no, Indiana has to have its own database. So our own layer of central planners can be, and then based on that, what they're planning to do is shift around state monies in response. So for example, if you're earning more money as a machinist, which in Indiana, the average machinist salary is $72,000. Not a bad living, you know, in a state where the average income is in the upper 40s. What they're planning to do is say, look, we will give, you know, you more money in college. It'll be cheaper for you to go to college if you're going to be a machinist because you can earn money and therefore pay us more taxes, straight up. What this does, of course, is takes out the individual choice, the individual responsibility for saying whether, look, I am a good fit for machining or not a good fit for machining. So the federal government is also, as part of its grants to states, in order to get this money from the federal government has been telling states this is the criteria. They want them to combine social data. They want them to combine social services data from the child welfare system. Have you ever had a visit at your door from the police, from, you know, social services? Have you ever had a hotline, you know, called on your house? Have you ever had, you know, the police come and, you know, check up if things are okay, this, that, or the other? So combine that with this education data, students' test scores, what the teacher is, what they want to, one of the recent minutes I read from our Indiana council is they want to write down specifically what classes each child has had, put that into their data file. And so the federal government also wants them to combine medical information. They have a national education data model. That's the phrase of it. You can also Google that and see it. It has 416 data points that the federal government is offering to states as a model of what to track about children. That includes their religion down to denomination, like Assembly of God, Mormon, Seventh-day Adventist, Catholic. Included in the model is what is your parents' health insurance, of course, what's your parents' income, as well as all the racial characteristics and so on and so forth. So that is what the federal government is telling states that they think would be good to be collected upon the children of the country. I mean, I know this sounds crazy Orwellian, but I think now that I'm giving you some of this information, you can understand why in the beginning I was very direct about what I've been saying. And if you, I have actually put all of this information in an academically published paper with more than 400 footnotes to the original sources with two lawyers from the Pioneer Institute. If you go to pioneerinstitute.org/common-core and you look under legality, our paper is called Cogs in the Machine, and it talks about all this data mining information. You can get all the original sources there. It's hyperlinked back to this. I'm not making any of this up. So our government, state and federal level, are creating interconnected databases that are planning to track your children at basically whatever point they can get their information. So for some Indiana information about that, Indiana requires you, I know this because I've recently had, packs of children, requires you to send your child's blood spot, the heel stick they do to test for genetic abnormalities. And look, I want that test done, right? If my baby is sick, if he has a problem, I want to know about that early so that my baby can get medical care, right? What parent, doesn't want that? But pursuant to a new federal law, Indiana is required to collect that blood spot, including your child's DNA, forever. And in fact, before that law passed, Indiana was already holding all of those blood spots about her children, even though you had a right to opt out from that collection. You could say, after you test my child's blood, destroy this within 6 months, which I checked that every single time, because what do they need my child's genetic data for? He's not a criminal. He's a baby. But now, thanks to the federal government, your lawmakers have passed a law saying that, they're going to keep that about every single baby done. I don't know about you, but for example, so when my children are vaccinated, if they don't get the vaccinations precisely on schedule, I get letters from the government, telling me, by the way, did you know that your baby, didn't have this vaccination according to schedule? And I say, yes, I do. It was a week late. What are you going to do? Send, people to the door? Thanks. So it's just a little creepy, right? Okay. And let's see here. So there's a lot of information here that I could spend a lot of time on, but I'm going to move on because there's a lot more that I'm going to talk about. But I think being aware of the existence of these databases, not only that, but the interest of collecting all of this information about your child into one data repository. When you complain about this, which I testified to Indiana's legislature about precisely this issue, so the response is, well, we are connecting all of that information, that profile of your child, to an anonymized identification number. So it's not actually attached to your child's name. That's basically either an ignorant statement from a data professional's point of view, or it's deceptive, deliberately deceptive. Because, and this is in the paper that I mentioned as well, the Cogs in the Machine paper, for decades, data technicians have been able to match information in a child's record up with a child's name if they just know 7 points of data. And those 7 points of data are things like, it's not the child's name, it's things like birth, date, month, not the day, just the month in the year. They will include things like, the family income. And these are all things if your child has ever gone to public school or on record about them in one of these, databases. And public schools have an incentive to collect more information about children because they get more money for children based on them being lower income, based on the children being of a certain race. The public schools want to be collecting more information on behalf of the government because they have financial reasons to do so. I, however, have a motherly reason to protect my kids from being treated like, they're the government's herd of cattle. Excuse me for being so direct. So right now what is before Congress, and this is an action item, there is a bill called the Socio-Emotional Testing and Research Act, CETRA. What that is doing is Congress wants to send a bunch of money to have states and private organizations developing tests where they record your child's non-academic attributes, things like beliefs, mindsets, and behavior. So because everything is online now, if a teacher is tracking your child's behavior in school, so your child has a bad day, if your teacher is using an app, for example, called Class Dojo, that creates a data trail of every single time that your child has been, you know, acted up in class in the past year because the teacher is, you know, touching that on her little screen. And so that it can be connected to your child's data file, you know. So the more information that's collected into this record about the child, you know, it is not a crazy thing to say. Someone who is reviewing your child's application for college could look at his behavior reports in kindergarten. Conservative commentator Michelle Malkin looked at a program like this in Colorado. They were recording kids' ability to go to the potty, right? So included in his data file was, you know, little Johnny, 4-year-old Johnny, how well he could pull up his pants, how fast he went to the bathroom. And again, you know, who needs to be collecting this information about your child, and why does it need to be connected to a lifelong record that could be present to an employer, that could be present, you know, to a college admissions official? That's none of their business. So the federal government right now are in Congress. There's that bill that would authorize more experiments to be doing these sort of information, collecting information on kids. So it's important that, you know, that even though people say, well, this is going to be anonymous, there is no practical way of making it anonymous. Just given the ability of data in our age, and our paper explains precisely how, you know, you can match the data sets very easily, and researchers have done that for years. So anyone who tells you the opposite either doesn't know jack about data or they're lying to you. Okay. As well as, I mean, you all know, medical breaches, hackers happen all the time. I had, a letter sent from I went to a ReadyMed, right? I forget. I had, like, some infection that wouldn't go away. I went to ReadyMed to, you know, get a doctor's prescription to get out of having to go on an airplane. So I received, as a result of that, ReadyMed was hacked, right? And so I got a letter saying, basically, we can't do anything for you. All of, you know, your social security number, which I had given out to them, so to prove that I was going to pay the bill for that visit. You know, all of that is online, and we're sorry, but tough luck for you. So basically, if the information has been collected, there is no way of anyone assuring that it can be private. So my position on that is, therefore, it shouldn't be collected in the first place. Okay. And so the last thing I wanted to mention here is, I mentioned that all the goal of this, the justification for this, again, from Republicans, who ought to know better because they tell us they support free markets and so forth, the goal is economic planning. So basically, you know, implementing Soviet-style 5-year plans. And we all know, well, I wish we all knew how well that didn't work out, but, you know, given the state of education among the populace, maybe we don't know how well that worked out. But basically, when you have government controlling things, you have shortages and you have people suffering. It is far, far more better for individuals to have them taking care of their own interests, because this prevents death. Literally, this prevents death. I wish I didn't have to say that, but that's the truth. Okay. So I just wanted to read this quote that was in the Indy Star, and it's big story on the Indiana Network of Knowledge. Ivy Tech COO Jeff Terp said, it will allow the state to track the return on investment, the number of people trained, the better jobs they get, and how much more revenue they generate for the state. So your children are revenue generators for the state, and so are you, and don't you forget it, y'all. Okay, we're going to move on. Birth and preschool. I already mentioned that Indiana has, because of the blood spot database, they have a record of your child's DNA starting at birth. It's just a matter of time before they connect that, you know, to the rest of the databases that they're collecting on our children. So that, again, you know, that we have the database then going back to just 2 days after the child is born, you know, the same day the child is born. So Indiana recently passed a preschool pilot program. The Indiana Network of Knowledge is planning to integrate baby data of all the children that attend the preschool pilot program in Indianapolis, because, of course, they want to prove that taking your money and spending it on people, other people, to give them daycare. I have done a lot of research on preschool. It's basically daycare. The long-term outcomes to children are no better. You know, and every single study that has been done long-term of government preschool has shown no long-term benefits to children. And so we still have our lawmakers coming us and telling us that we're going to help children who are needy. And good luck. I am all about helping needy children, but if the research doesn't say that this helps needy children, we're going to have to try something else. Anyway, that is not what they want to hear. So the Indiana Network of Knowledge is already, there's already kids in this preschool pilot. The Indiana Network of Knowledge has pulled in their medical records from their pediatricians, and that's now part of the state database on their behalf. Here are some proposed research questions from INC, from this Indiana Network of Knowledge. This is what they want to do with the data. Among all young children from birth to age 5, this I'm quoting from, you know, their recent documents, before kindergarten entry, what early childhood services did they receive? Child care, pre-K, Head Start, home visiting, early intervention, special education, preschool. I have a homeschooling friend whose child receives speech therapy, 3-year-old little girl from the local public school district. You know, now she's enrolled in the state's database tracking her outcomes. What percentage of this population receives more than one state service? Here's another question, and I'm quoting again. What are the commuting patterns of Indiana's workforce? What route do you take on your way to work, moms and dads? This would link employment, industry, demographics, educational profile, and residency with commuting patterns. I want you to remember this because in a little bit I'm going to talk about how the federal government is using its databases to plan your neighborhood to decide who's going to live next to you. And I, again, this sounds like crazy, crazy helicopter stuff, but this is literally happening. You know, federal regulation already passed into place. News articles about it, you can go ahead and Google all of it. Okay, here's another key research question for the preschool program that our state data collectors want to ask. How does access to early care and education programs differ based on locale? For example, rural or urban, suburban demographics. For example, socioeconomic status, race, parent education level, etc., and program quality levels. And what are the differences in kindergarten readiness levels, including social and emotional readiness? They're going to evaluate children's social behavior, who they play with, whether they play nice, if so-and-so is friends with so-and-so, and why not, and their emotional states. I don't know about you, but I have preschoolers. They have horrible emotional states, you know, and hopefully they'll be well-adjusted adults by the time they're 20, and nobody needs to know about it. And academic performance through grade 3 for children who participate in early childhood education opportunities, and here's a key part, those who do not. So by virtue of the state passing programs like this, they need to compare kids who are enrolled with their programs with kids who are not. The kids who are not are your children. Okay, here's another one that makes it even more pointed. How does program quality differ based on program type? For example, and this is all a quote, public versus private, accredited versus non-accredited. Y'all are non-accredited home schools, according to our state law. Funding source, for example, federal funds, state funds, and location, for example, in-home versus school-based. Again, the fact that this exists implicates you because your children are the control group. Okay. We're going to move on to talking about curriculum and Common Core. Important thing that a lot of people do not know about Common Core is that Common Core itself is a database. So let me explain that for you. So Common Core is this 600-page long list of what a bunch of bureaucrats whose names we are not entitled to know, even though we paid their salaries and our state has their program in our schools. It lists what they think kids need to know at every grade from, you know, K through 12. And they are arranged in such a way that Common Core itself is basically, what is the word that I use for it? Common Core itself is basically like a filing system. It is an organizing scheme for arranging knowledge. So, for example, each little thing that Common Core says that a child needs to know in each grade has a number tag attached to it. And so, folks that are creating online curriculum, online tests, attach every single question, sometimes every single sentence, to one of those Common Core number tags. So how a child does on a test, they fit it into the Common Core schema to see how the child, in very minute respect, stacks up against Common Core, what Common Core wants them to learn. So Common Core is not just a list of requirements for what a curriculum has to contain, but a way of measuring and evaluating children. And that is how it was deliberately set up that way, because that is a way that makes it the most useful for getting data out of tests your child takes. So if your child takes the I-STEP, if your child takes the SAT and the ACT, which have been changed to fit Common Core, I mean, and most of you, you know, your kids are going to, I took, you know, the SAT and the ACT. Most homeschooled kids do take these tests. So based on their answers on that, they are being measured against Common Core, and Common Core includes some of these psychosocial aspects that I mentioned earlier. So for example, there's some federal papers that talking about the Common Core tests that the Obama administration funded with your money, talked about how the test can, because Common Core says it should measure kids' persistence in math, that's a way for the test to measure how persistent your child is. That's a character quality, right? That's not, does your child know how to add? Can he multiply two-digit numbers? These are the things that we think are happening on tests. But the same with CETRA, these sort of tests that are being put into place by, you know, government officials at different, they are not really interested in the knowledge that your child has. They don't care that much about whether he can add, about whether he can read, about whether he can do concrete, objective academic things. What they care about are his social adjustment. I'm not making that up. These are direct quotes from the folks who are writing the tests. So the tests are moving all towards these soft skills, soft behavior, again, doing the job of the parents while schools are not doing the job of the schools, right? The job of the school is to teach your kid academic knowledge. Job of the parent is to decide how persistent my child is, whether he is patient enough, and how I'm going to work with him and helping develop his patience. So if the idea of having government decide how, you know, persistent your child is and whether he measures up and what measures they're going to apply to remediate him scares you, you know, this is the sort of thing that you should be voicing and objecting to your lawmakers. So the thing about Common Core is I actually support people doing Common Core freely. If they freely choose it, they want to do it, that is their business. I believe in freedom, right? But the problem that I have is with people who think that Common Core is really great, getting to come into my home and say, you know, we're going to judge you by what Common Core says children should learn. I'll say, excuse me, you know, I have my own priorities for what children should learn. I don't think my child needs to be studying menus and picking out, you know, pieces of EPA regulations, which are recommended reading from Common Core exemplar texts. You know, I'm doing other things in my homeschool, and if my kid can't do that really well, I'm not that concerned, thanks. So they are granting themselves the right to basically say, stamp your child educated or not educated based on their own criteria, when you and I think, have very different criteria, and I'm sure we all feel our criteria is better. So what that allows them to do is control access to programs based on their criteria of what an educated human being is, rather than giving you the freedom, you know, to take him to a college, to take him to an employer and say, look, this is what my child can do. Here's an essay he wrote. You know, he can do quadratic equations out the wazoo, right? You know, look at his algebra scores. So they're removing from your child the ability to demonstrate what he can actually do and substituting them as the gatekeeper for your child's opportunities in life. So if you folks are interested in learning, part of the objection that I have to Common Core is that it has taken over a lot of the curriculum that homeschoolers use. So because, a great majority of public schools and private schools are using Common Core, that's a big market for an education publisher, for a testing company. And so they shift to match what Common Core is, and that narrows the offerings that are available to you to be doing something different. So if you want to be checking what your child is doing, what your family is doing, you can Google Homeschool Resource Roadmap. A group of homeschooling parents has checked, you know, has literally called up the various curriculum companies to see whether they're aligned with Common Core, just to give you the information to make your own choices about what you want to be doing with your children. They have done all the tests. They've asked all the major tests. So that way you can give your child a good test to know how your child is doing without having him being judged against Common Core. And a little privacy note there. If what I do when my children take tests is instead of using their name or their social security number, you know, you ask the testing company or you just put on identification number, right? So my first child is 00101. So the testing company doesn't know that that's my baby, right? But I know he's, you know, number one, first kid, you know, so that way you can still use the test without having it attached to your child and having them know that, you know, your specific child, Johnny Smith's score was this back when he was in third grade. Okay, and so that brings us to the other item to talk about, which is that tests are the enforcement mechanism that folks use. I don't know if you all have heard about the opt-out movement across the country. A number of families are, you know, requesting the ability to opt out of tests. And not only that, this is of particular interest to homeschool families, because the SAT and ACT, which of course we have to use to justify our admission to college, right, because a college admissions person doesn't know that mommy didn't just give Johnny A's while he watched, you know, whatever is going on TV nowadays. So we like having tests because it proves in their eyes, you know, we weren't just sitting on the couch eating Cheetos watching Mr. Magoo. So there's a group of folks who are creating an alternative entrance exam called VectorArc. They are right now in their beta testing, and they need homeschool families. If your child has taken a SAT or ACT test, they need you to be an anonymous, basically, tester for their test. That's an independent one. It will not do data mining, and they're trying to compete with SAT and ACT. Again, you can Google it, VectorArc, A-R-C. And so if you have a homeschool group where you have a number of teenagers, you know, who have taken the test and you're willing to basically help them calibrate their exam, they would appreciate the help. They need 400 more kids, last I talked with the lady in charge of it, to help them do that, to be able to give you more options in your college entrance test besides ones that are basically going to function as scoops to get your child herded into the Common Core system. Yes, ma'am. Yes, vector, like vectors in physics, V-E-C-T-O-R. Okay, and so I also wanted to talk about a couple of other policies that really matter to homeschooling families. I'm going to start first with discipline. So if those of you, so we're at the Indiana, you know, Homeschool Conference, Association of Home Educators. I'm sorry, my brain has so many acronyms in it that I have to go through each one individually. But so Debbie has recently been worked, she sent out an alert recently about the state working on its discipline and dropouts policy. And so this is a prime example of how public school rules really matter to homeschooling families. Because the state basically found that some local principals, they have really, really unruly kids. They were telling families, in some instances, go homeschool your child. Well, they obviously, a child who typically, I mean, there's exceptions, but a child who is acting like a crazy person at age 16 has some home problems, most likely. And so that child, when they were homeschooling, were not being homeschooled. They were dropouts. And so the state wants to track those children. And so basically, this is an excuse. They're rewriting a report to the federal government that will lead to more regulation that implicate, you know, basically may require you to justify whether you're educating your children simply because some people who are dropouts call themselves homeschoolers. Do you see how that works, right? What public policy works in such a way that, like, the deviation from the norm gets to determine what all the normal, well-behaved people do. You know, it's basically turned on its head. Our policies are not constructed to trust you as a parent because you're not a crazy psycho abuser. You're not a meth head, right? You care about your children so much that you're willing to, you know, deal with the little critters way more than a lot of other parents. But, you know, of course, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and so, you know, the squeaky folks are the ones who, if we're not careful, get to determine whether the rest of us have to live in fear and have government checking up on our curriculum like they do in other states. Indiana has very good homeschool policies. A number of states literally have, so for New York, for example, you have to take twice a year your curriculum into the local public school and have them tell you and approve whether what you're doing is okay with them, which is just crazy to me, right? Because they cannot teach. We just had the most recent results of the National Assessment of Educational Progress. National tests given every 2 years showed biggest drop in 20 years in math achievement among high schoolers. So obviously, our public schools aren't really great at educating children. We've known this for 50 years. But they, you know, may have the power, even though they can't do well with the children under their care, and homeschooled children have way better test scores, they have way better results, way better adjustment. You know, the people who can't manage and who have worse adjusted kids are going to tell the people who have better adjusted kids how they should be doing things. But again, that's the way that these things go if you don't make your voice heard. So that's an issue there to be aware of. I'm going to give you a couple of action points in a few seconds. I realize I've given you a couple about how to be monitoring things like this, paying attention, and being active. But another one is our government debt bomb. And this is a way that the public schools problems directly threaten you as a parent, as a taxpayer, because Indiana, like many other states, has very large public pension liabilities. Not only that, I mean, we spend approximately $12,000 per year per child in public school, and half of the people employed by Indiana public schools are not teachers. half of the people employed by Indiana Public Schools are not teachers. So we basically have this expensive bureaucratic system, and the worse that they do and the more money that they spend, the higher your taxes are going to be. Let's just be honest here. And so, like most other states, you know, Indiana, our pension, our healthcare systems, the public schools' inability to do, I mean, think about what you could do with $12,000 a year, right? I've sat there and dreamed about going to Europe, visiting the Sistine Chapel, you know? Imagine what I could do with my four little babies with $12,000 a year, you know, year each for them. It would be glorious. But no. Anyway. So, you know, the functioning of public schools is directly affects your ability to pay for homeschooling, because let's be real here. We all pay for homeschooling on top of the taxes to support public schools that our kids are not going to. So, you know, that is in our interest to keep public schools efficient. I mean, of course, a bigger, like, less self-interested reason is that all those people that public schools are educating vote. Well, if you don't like the way that your fellow citizens vote, maybe you should be concerned with the primary influence on them. Well, I mean, actually, the primary influence on them is mass culture. And that's another story for another day. But, you know, a major influence on them is what happens in the schools. And that's one of the reasons that you cannot hide. You know, you can't close your door, because when your kids grow up, you know, all their peers, the majority of whom, 93% of Indiana kids go into public schools, they're going to be voting for who's going to be in charge of your life, who's going to be in charge of your kids' life. And so whether public schools teach Common Core, whether our state puts forth social studies standards that teaches our kids, you know, antithetical to limited government principles about how government should work, that matters to you, because you live in this state too. The last thing I wanted to talk about is related to this question that I mentioned earlier of studying the demographic patterns of neighborhoods. Have you all, who in this room has heard about affirmatively furthering fair housing rule? Has anybody? Got two people. Oh, this is going to blow your mind. So the Obama administration recently put into place a rule called, again, this is a rule, it is against the letter of the law, but Congress does not have a backbone, so they keep giving him money, and so he keeps doing whatever he wants. The Obama administration put into place a rule called the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Act. It has been using this rule in Baltimore and in Westchester, New York, to require local taxpayers to place people of preferred racial groups in their suburbs. They are having to build high-rise apartment complexes paid for at the local taxpayers' expense, and they are required to, basically, they're coming into neighborhoods and saying, you don't have the mix of people with the right amount of money and the right amount of race that we think is best for you, so we're going to make you, your local government, take your money and build houses for people of the right, quote-unquote, you know, income level, ethnic background. That is set to expand directly after the 2016 election. So what we have is this happening in Indianapolis as well. There's a proposed, there's basically a proposed change to kind of the public transportation system. I don't know if y'all are, you probably, a lot of you don't live in Indianapolis. I don't either. But this is not, you know, just something happening over in Westchester. This is a national rule that is going to affect your neighborhood and also affects your tax rates and your ability. I mean, look, you know, my family, we live in a very mixed neighborhood. You know, I worry about my kids being pushed around by the kids coming home from the local public school, because they do. You know, they march on our lawn. They have handed my children candy. I don't know what's in that candy. I don't want them taking candy from strangers. You know what I mean? So your ability to protect your children from things like that is dramatically, is eliminated. You know, if you have people in charge of you who are not held accountable for doing this sort of thing to you. As well as, again, like the cost to local taxes is immense. And again, I don't know about you, but it's hard to pay for taxes as well as for our kids' private education on top of that with our own family's money. Okay. We are right about at the end here. I'm going to talk about a couple of things that I recommend that you do about this state of affairs. The first one is that, you, like I said earlier, you can't hide. So you have to realize as homeschoolers that your ability to have education freedom is directly tied to everybody else in this state and in this country's ability to have education freedom. We are all in this together. Homeschoolers are very effective politically because they pay attention and they are loud and they are persistent. And I appreciate that about you because to be dramatic for a second, the forces of freedom need all the help we can get. So some things that you can do, just be aware. Look, I am a mother of little children. You know, it's hard for me to be here today because I have a nursing baby. I get that you have, you know, people screaming at you all day long. You've got your toddlers, you've got your kids, you're educating them yourself. You're a busy person. Do what you can. And in my mind, when I think of it, I think of it like the biblical story of Nehemiah. You know, I've got my trowel in one hand building the wall, and I've got my sword in the other. And the sword is the phone call. The sword is showing up anytime you can at a key rally. So in order for you to be able to do that, I would get on email list. So you should be on the Indiana homeschooler Debbie's email newsletter to get alerts about things like this discipline rule that the state is, you know, proposing and talking to the federal government about. I know there's a debate in the homeschooling community about this, but I personally support Homeschool Legal Defense Association, really cheap family homeschooling insurance, and they fight at the federal level for exclusions for all of us. I work with the Homeschool Legal Defense folks on the Common Core legislation, on the national legislation. They are very effective, and they are very good. They pay very good attention. So for $110, $120 a year, you know, you're basically, again, you're providing insurance, you're providing a bulwark for all of us, you know, to help HSLDA fight on all of our behalf. And because we are a key primary state, I know this is a nonprofit organization, I'm aware of electioneering rules, so I'm just going to give you a quick summary. Please vote on Tuesday in Indiana's primary. We are a crucial state in the presidential election. Get all your friends to go. Hillary Clinton not only supports Common Core, I'm writing a big article right now about how Hillary Clinton tried to nationalize education when her husband was in office, along with her plan for nationalizing health care. She has come out publicly, you know, in support of Common Core for, you know, obviously. So that's her record on that issue. Donald Trump gave an interview with Anderson Cooper of CNN in Wisconsin right before their primary there, in which he said that he thinks education is one of the three core functions of the federal government, along with health care and national security. And my position on that is that the federal government is the reason we are in this mess. The more power they have, the less power we have. Ted Cruz supports homeschooling. He supports giving families the right to opt out of testing that they find objectionable. I worked with his staff at the federal level on legislation. He may be the most pro-freedom and education person at any level that I have ever worked with or seen. So that's a quick rundown of them. Please vote in this primary. Please get all your friends to vote in this primary. And let's see here. So the last thing that I want to talk about is just as a closing call to action. One of the things, as someone who has worked in education policy, not just homeschooling, is that, you know, how do you say it? We all fight for our own families, right, which is totally logical. But the rest of us, I'm a homeschooler too now, everybody needs your help defending their families as well. For many people, homeschooling is not possible or not immediately possible. And so you standing up to vote for and to make your voices heard for our state and national legislators is protecting everybody. And given the position that we're in, we need everybody, all hands on deck, because it is a very grave situation where the government thinks that your children are not your children. So if you think that you should be the person who has the primary authority over your family and get to make your own choices, then you need to be standing up and making that case in the public square while you still can. And so I thank you for being here today, and I'm happy to take questions until the next speaker boots me out. Yes, ma'am. If you go to libertylawsite.org and look up Dr. Terrence Moore's work on that, he is a Hillsdale College professor who did, at Governor Pence's request, an independent evaluation of Common Core. Terrence Moore at the Liberty Law Site, I think it's .org. And I have his full evaluation that he sent to the governor. I'll give you my email address, joy.pullman@gmail.com. If you email me, I will send that to you if you want kind of the full overview of that as well. Don't forget the second N in my last name. Yes, ma'am. Homeschool Resource Roadmap. Mm-hmm. Any other folks? Thanks for coming, everyone. I love homeschoolers. I'm glad to be here today. You have a good afternoon.